morning. My name's Kip Collins, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's May 12, 1984. And my home group is Robber's Roost. It's a men's meeting, closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meets on Thursday night. My sponsor's name is Pat T. And my grand sponsor's name is Harry O. Oh, I didn't know that. I always thought it was Harry H. But I want to thank the committee for bringing me up here. I get to participate in a little bit of Alcoholics Anonymous around the country, and you guys got something nice here. This has been nice. It's been like being at my home group. I mean, I love the way you pick on each other, you know? The way you keep each other humble. That's like my group, you know? We have no big shots in my group. If you think you are, they'll let you know real quick, you know? And I like that. I like that. You guys have just been great. I felt like I've been home. One thing I want, before I get started, I want to thank Harry. You know, I never got a chance to do this, and it's just such an honor. Harry didn't even know it, but when I was real new. And see, you'll get to hear my story. I'm not a member of society, and I had never been one. And Harry invited me into his home, a special deal, him and his lovely, lovely wife. And I can remember that so clearly. I was real reluctant, you know, because I don't go into nice square people's houses. And I'm never invited. And he invited me there, and Harry had what I wanted. And Harry has always been one of my peers that I've always wanted to grow in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be the kind of man that he is and the way he carries himself. And he carries a good message here, but I'll tell you, I see him at home. And the man walks like he talks, and he has a life of Alcoholics Anonymous that I envy and I want, and he's my hero. And thank you, Harry. Thank you. Well, here we go. I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. My father's Irish and Sioux, and my mother's Irish and Cherokee. And when my daddy drank, my mama liked to fight. And my daddy liked to drink every single day. And my mama liked to fight every single day. And the way it was at my house, you'd be waiting for the old man to get home. And the later it got, you know, I don't know if any of you raised in alcoholic homes, but when that, you're waiting for the drunk to get home, you know, and the tension starts to build in the house. And see, my mom's not afraid of nobody. And she's pacing, waiting for him to get home. And the longer it takes, the madder she is. We're not afraid of my dad, we're afraid of my mom. And it's getting crazier and crazier, and pretty soon you hear the truck pull in, you know, and he's bouncing off the curbs coming up the road. And if you looked out the windows, you'd see all the neighbors turning off their lights and coming outside with their lawn chairs, you know. And it's getting ready to rock and roll at the Collins house tonight, you know. And that's the way it was. It was like that all the time. It never changed. He was either getting kicked out, or he was talking his way back into the house, one or the other, you know, for years and years. And I do not blame my alcoholism on my father whatsoever. You know, if anything in the world, my father taught me what alcohol will do to a family. He taught me what it'll do to a marriage. He taught me what it'll do to children, to a career. So I have no illusions about alcohol and what it'll do. I can't put it on him. You know, I like to blame it on the San Diego Unified School District. They had a great idea in the early 60s about, they're going to bring in all the young people into these classes. I heard you guys talking about that today, or in the beginning, about your school committees. And they had that back then, and it wasn't AA, but it was a community. And they come in, these people, and they were showing these movies about this stuff that we don't talk about in AA too much. And they had these people come in and talk, you know, and they're talking. They showed us this movie, and these people talked. And man, when the lights came back on, I hit my buddy Balto Morales in the ribs, and I said, Balto, can you get some of this stuff? And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, he says, get it. And I said, I'll meet you after school. So the next day I said, you get it? He goes, yeah. So what do? He goes, I don't know. He said, well, we got to stop and we got to steal some wine. I said, some wine? What for? He goes, I don't know. He says, every time my dad smokes his stuff, he always drinks wine with it. So we went in this little market and I stole a short dog of sweet red port. And we went down this canyon. And I fired that thing up. And I opened that bottle of wine and I took a big drink of it, and it came right straight back up. and I took another drink of it, and it settled down and burned all the way down, and then something started happening inside of me, and I experienced my absolute first spiritual experience. You know? And I don't say that jokingly. It was a spiritual experience. You know, I was raised in a neighborhood. All my cousins have very dark hair. They have dark skin. They have brown eyes. All the kids in our neighborhood were all Mexican. Me and my brother were the only Anglos in the whole neighborhood. And they all had dark hair, brown eyes, and dark skin, and they didn't speak English. And I was born with white hair and blue eyes and very white skin, and so was my brother. And we stood out in that neighborhood like a sore thumb. And I went outside and the Mexicans wanted to beat my ass. And I went in the house and the Indians wanted to beat my ass, you know? And I didn't fit in anywhere, you know? I didn't fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in with the family, with any of my relatives, and I didn't fit in my neighborhood. And I was scared, you know? I learned at a very early age, you know, if you get your ass beat plenty of times, if you can make those people afraid of you, they'll stop beating on you. And that's what I learned. And I learned that if you showed fear, they'd eat you up, you know? And so me and my brother, we just got real nuts and real crazy. And it wasn't because we were tough, we were scared. And that's the way I felt all my life. I was absolutely terrified of this world. I was afraid to go outside. There was violence outside. There was violence in my home. There was violence in my school. And I was just absolutely terrified. But when I drank that alcohol, it was the most magic moment of my life. It just kind of melted that fear away. It just kind of dissolved, and you know, and my hair started getting dark brown, and my skin started getting dark, and my eyes started turning brown, and I could speak Spanish all of a sudden. And I knew about these first three steps a long time before I knew about you people. You know, I knew I was powerless over this world. Absolutely powerless over it. I knew my life was a mess. It was just totally unmanageable. Everything was just crazy, constantly, total chaos at all times. And I smoked this dope and I drank this wine. And I came to believe in a power greater than myself. You know, and I immediately, with no reservation, I turned my will and life over to it. And I never looked back. A couple years later, my mom found my stash, and the first thing that happened, I hit a teacher at school, and they kicked me out of school, San Diego Unified School District. They didn't have any continuation school or nothing. They just totally expelled me from the whole thing. They told me that I was antisocial. And I got home, and a couple days later, my mom had found my stash, and she got mad. She kicked me out of the house. And you know, I'd been waiting for someone to kick me out of that house since I was 2 years old, you know. And the minute she said go, I was gone, man. It was just like they opened the door on a trapped rabbit, and I ran as fast as I could to get out of there. And I ran over to Carlsbad, California, to a friend of mine's house, and I'd never been anywhere, I'd never done anything, and I'm looking, and this friend of mine is going, well, check this out, Kip. He says, all these people are going up to San Francisco, and all they do up there is they get high and listen to music and make love. I like music, you know, and I got on the road. I was 14 years old, and I hitchhiked up to San Francisco, and I moved into a neighborhood called Haight-Ashbury, and they were right, man. Things were rocking there. It was just, there was so much excitement, so much fun, so much music, and I'm going to tell you, I didn't make a good hippie. I failed that miserably. I've been fighting all my life, and I don't know any other thing, you know. If someone says something to me or gets in my face, it's on. And these guys were very pacifist, and they were always telling me, hey man, you know, give peace a chance, and I'm going, yeah, right. And I grew hair good though, you know, I could grow hair real good. And I love their women, and you know, and I like their drugs, and I like their music, but I just didn't quite fit in there. But I found out at a very early age that I wasn't really a hippie. I found out that I was basically, at my heart of hearts, just a capitalist pig, you know. I saw opportunity. That's all I saw. You know, I just saw opportunity. I saw supply and demand. They wanted all this stuff. All my friends come from Mexico. I know where this stuff comes from. And I go down and I go see my lifelong friend, Balto. And Balto's family's in that business. And so we go down to Mexico and we talk to his family and we start a little business going, you know. And everything went real, real well for a couple of years. And then I got arrested in Mexico when I was 16 years old with 200 kilos of marijuana. And I went to prison in Mexico. And I'll tell you straight up, nice things don't happen to 16-year-old white guys with long blonde hair and blue eyes. Everything in this world that ought to top me, you know, this ain't happening. But you see, I'm an alcoholic, and I have a poor perception of this world, and I'm very used to abuse. It's part of life. It don't scare me. And it turned out to be probably one of my best career moves in my life. My partner Balto, he came back down there. He had relatives that were in that jail, and they hooked me up, and I love Mexico. I spent a lot of my life in Mexico, and Mexico is a very civilized country. You know, it works on the principle of mordida, and that means the little bite. And that means you just have to know who to pay, you know, and you got to know who to give the money to. And that, and you can buy and you can have anything you want if you have money. And I had money. And I found out the right people to get the money to. And I hooked up with some people in there and that I did business with for the rest of my life. And it worked out okay. You know, I was in jail for 9 months down there. And when I got out, I got back across the border. And I continued to do what I was doing, you know. On my 18th birthday, I was living with this gal, wonderful little woman, Spanish girl, and she was pregnant. And we were so excited. I was really excited, you know. I listened to other men talk when we were kids about what they wanted to be when they grew up, what kind of man they wanted to be, and you know, they wanted to be firemen and cops and all this stuff, you know, that young men want to grow up to be. And you know, I didn't know what kind of trade I wanted to do, but I know one thing I wanted more than anything in the life, and I remember that all my life. I wanted a family. I wanted children more than anything in the world. I wanted to have a child. I wanted a son. I wanted a son to go do all the things that I dreamed about doing all my life. And she was going to have a baby, and I was so excited about that. And 5:30 in the morning on my 18th birthday, the police broke in, and I was charged with 27 felonies, and I went to prison. When I was 18 years old, they said they waited. They knew my birthday was the next day, and they waited till I was 18 so they could put me in prison. You know, bastards. You know, the only thing that bothered me about that was I was worried about this woman, and I was really concerned about this child. And all through that term, I never heard from her. She never wrote me. She never came to see me. I would try to call, and the number had been disconnected. And I never got any visitors, and I never got a letter from anybody. I never heard nothing. And when I got out of there, I went to go try to find them, and I couldn't find them. The family had sent her to Texas, and they wanted nothing to do with me. They said stay out of her life. And for many years, man, there was a big hole in my gut, wondering about that baby. You know, I started running around doing what I was doing, and you know, and I kept going to jail. And I ran into this little girl. She was 15 years old, just gorgeous, and she came from a very wealthy family. And I had a real bad week, and I'd gone to jail 3 times that week. And she bailed me out of jail every single time. And the last time, she woke up a judge at 3 o'clock in the morning to make bail for me. And I don't know nothing about love, nothing at all, but I do know about jail. And I know that if there's anyone in this world that won't go to bed till I get out of jail, I want them on my side, you know? And I married her as soon as I got out, you know? I married her, and old Kathy, and her ears are still ringing. You know, we continued doing what we were doing. I got busted again, went back to jail again, and after I got out, I was on parole. She was pregnant. And I knew I was never gonna make parole in California, so I went up to a little town in Oregon. Only had 200 people. I said, I can't get in too much trouble here. And I didn't, you know. And one day, she says, we got to go to the hospital. And I said, okay, I'm going to go have the baby. We got to the hospital, and they came out, and they brought this little boy. and I experienced my second spiritual experience. I'll never forget it as long as I live. I look at that little baby, and the only thing, I don't have the vocabulary to put it out in words. Maybe you can understand the feelings. My heart exploded. It just absolutely exploded. I looked at that little boy, and for the very first time in my whole life since I've been on this planet, I experienced absolute, total, unconditional love for another human being. And I wasn't expecting it, you know, and it was so powerful. And I held that baby, and I looked at him, man, and I just loved him so much, and I promised him, I said, you know what, no one's ever going to hurt you. No one's ever going to abuse you. You're going to have everything. Me and you are going to do everything together. You're going to be my pal. And I meant it with everything I had. I came back down to California, and 2 years later, and we went to another hospital, and I waited in this waiting room, and they came out, and they put this little girl in my arms. And I had my third spiritual experience. But the same thing happened, and I looked at this little girl, and my heart exploded, and I fell just madly in love with her. And I promised her, I said, you're going to have everything. You're my princess. I'm going to give you everything in the world. No one will ever hurt you. You're going to have everything. I'm going to be your daddy. And I meant it with everything I had. And for the next 5 years, I could have been father of the year. The business I was in, I made a lot of money. I only worked a couple of times a year. And I'd be out of town for a few weeks, and then, you know, and that's all I did, and I didn't do anything. I stayed with my kids. I had a real nice place, and I stayed, and everything about me was about my children. I bathed them. I washed them. You know, I had a wife, but she was a wife. She bailed me out of jail. She kept things going. I never had much truck with women too much. I didn't understand you guys, but she was a nice gal, and I knew I could count on her. But my thing was my children, man. I just adored my children, and I taught them how to talk. I taught them how to walk, and my whole place was all fixed up for kids. We had a pond there so I could take my son fishing every single day, you know, and everything was playground equipment, and it was just for my kids, and that's what my life was about. And on September 6, 1976, my wife and my daughter had gone to town, they'd gone shopping, and they'd left me and my son there, and me and him were playing, and a friend of mine came over. It was a real hot day, and he brought something real good to smoke over, and I smoked this stuff. And he left, and it was real hot, and I got real, real thirsty. And I didn't even think about it, you know. I was kind of stoned, and I got on my bike, and I just went up the store to go get a six-pack of beer. And I come back down the road just a few minutes later, and the police were at my house, and the fire department was at my house, and all the neighbors were out in front of my house. And I got through the crowd of people, and I found out my son had chased me out of the driveway, and I didn't know about it. He got run over by a truck. And I saw my baby laying there in the street, and his head was split open, and I could see his brains, you know, and there was bones protruding from everywhere, and, you know, and a part of me died. And I sat with my son in intensive care in a hospital for 9 months in a coma, and I wouldn't leave. And I sat there, and I don't know nothing about God. You know, my family, they're all very religious. I don't know them too well, but they're all Pentecostal evangelists, and they had a God that scared me to death, you know. But I cried out, you know, if there's a God, man, give me back my son. I'll do anything. Just give me my son back. Let me have my son. And my son survived. But he couldn't hear, he couldn't talk. Emotionally and mentally never evolved beyond the age of about 4 years old. And he had incredible physical, mental, and emotional problems all of his life. And over the years, we went through 27 major emergency brain surgeries. And every time I looked at my baby, I knew whose responsibility this was. You know, who did this? You know, the other thing in my life was my brother Bill. And anything I've told you about, my brother Bill was by my side. We were 11 months apart, and we've been back in each other's play all of our lives since we hit this planet together. He was the only other human being in the world that I totally trusted with anything in the world. He was my best friend. He was my business partner. He was my confidant. He was the only human being in this world that I absolutely, totally trusted. And my brother came down with a disease called schizophrenia. And my family had him put in a hospital. Well, that happened while my son was in the hospital. And after he had got out, after a while, they got him stabilized on some medication. And he called me from that hospital and he says, "Kip, get me out of here, man." And I said, "Are you okay?" He says, yeah, just get me out of here." And it don't make no difference where he was. I got him out of there. You know, he was my brother. It was against my family's wishes and against the doctors. But, you know, he's my brother and he wants out. And I get him out. He asked me. That's just the way it is. Ain't nothing to talk about. And I brought him home. My brother lived on a little piece of property right next to me. And he had a mobile home there. After my son got out, he was in a special hospital. But I had to go make some money real quick to the medical bills, and everything was just staggering. And I put this deal together and I told my brother Bill, I said, "Bill, I'm going to be gone for 3 days. I got to go back east." I said, "I want you to watch Jana, watch my little girl, watch the place." You know what's up? You know. Can't go. And I said, "Bill, I gotta go." And I can't give him a handful of money. Money's fixed everything all my life. And I gave him a handful of money and I pulled his arms off of me and he was crying. I'd never seen my brother like this, you know? And I got in a car and I left. And this deal I was going through, it went sideways on me and I was gone for almost 3 weeks. I finally put everything together and I got back home and my daughter was there and I said, "Where's Bill?" And she goes, "I don't know, I haven't seen him." And I said, "No one's seen Bill." I said, "Well, where is he?" And so I went back to his mobile home and I opened the door and my brother's head rolled out. And 3 days after I left, he had taken a gun and he blew his head off and his body was laying in the doorway and it was just a big pile of maggots laying there. And something inside of me that time broke completely in half like a tree branch. And I don't tell you this. I don't tell you this because I want your sympathy or anything. The only reason I tell you this part of my story is just to drive home one real important factor. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, chapter 5, it talks about, it says, there's people who got here with grave emotional and mental disorders. And I'm one of those people. Something inside of me broke completely in half of my very soul that day. And I tell you this from my heart to yours, that I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. I thank God that alcohol does for me what it does for me. If alcohol doesn't do for me what it does for me, I wouldn't have been here today. You know, I would have joined my brother. But alcohol works on me. Alcohol does something to me that it doesn't do to other people. You know, alcohol takes away pain. It takes away guilt. It takes away those things inside of my head. It allows me to go to sleep at night. It stops the screaming when I get up in the morning. And it allows me to function in this world one day at a time, kind of comfortably compared to without. You know, things started happening in my life. I started drinking. I started drinking around the clock. Alcohol and drugs have been a lot of fun up to that point in my life. But, you know, I was in control at all times. But from that day forward, I wasn't in control of nothing. And my life started just kind of dissolving around me. And right about that time, my wife, she saw what was going on, and she was dealing with her own pain, because she loved my brother, man. She loved our son, and she was dealing with her own pain the only way she knew how, the same way I was. You know, I couldn't keep it together no more, and one of my business associates, she left with him. And she left me, and it was just, my son was in a special school, special hospital, and it was just me and my little girl, Jana. Jana was 5 years old, and up to this point, Jana's life had been absolutely beautiful. It had been a fairy tale, you know? She was just her daddy and her brother and her uncle, and it was just us all the time, and everything was wonderful. We didn't lack for nothing. We had a great time all the time, and all of a sudden, you know, her brother's gone, her uncle's gone, her mother's gone, and her daddy's acting real strange and real crazy, and she's scared to death. We're sitting on the couch and I'm just telling her, "Baby, I'm going to get it together. And I said, "We're going to be okay, don't worry." And I could see the fear in her eyes. She was scared, she didn't know what was going on. And this guy came over to my house that day and he brought this stuff. I doubt very much if you guys have ever heard about it in Canada. But in California, we call it Mad Dog 2020. And it's a fortified wine, 18%. And I'd never drank this stuff before. And I'm going to tell you, if there's anyone new here that's thinking about going out and taking another drink, I highly suggest Mad Dog 2020. It will run your rusty ass right back in here real quick, you know. I drank this stuff called Mad Dog 2020. And the only thing I know is that the next thing I knew, I was sitting in my living room and this lady said, "Excuse me, sir, you've got to get off the airplane." And I looked around and I'm in this big jet and it's completely empty and it's just my little girl's asleep next to me and I'm going, "Where the hell am I?" And I said, where are we? And she goes, "Well, you're in Fort Lauderdale." I said, "I don't like Fort Lauderdale." She goes, "I don't know nothing about that. You've got to get off the plane, sir." And so I got up and I woke my daughter up. I'm trying to put it together real quick. I can't figure out what's happened. And I start kind of questioning, you know, real my daughter about hoping she's going to give me a clue without raising alarm what we're doing in Florida. She hasn't any idea, you know. And so I do the next indicated thing. I got off the airplane and I just sat there for a minute and I called a cab. I said, "You know what, take me to a hotel and stop at a liquor store because I need to figure out what's happened here." And I come to and I'm strapped down on this table and I don't have any clothes on. I've done some weird stuff in my life. I didn't think I was having a good time. And I didn't know where my daughter was. I didn't know where I was. And I found out that I met a couple at this hotel and we started drinking this wild turkey and doing some other additives. And I just went berserk and they called the cops and the cops didn't know what to do with me and everything. I was just nuts and crazy. And they took me to county mental health and they strapped me down and I came to and I started putting it together and the doctor came in to tell me and I'm telling him about all this trauma that I've been through and this is a big mistake. Let me go. I'm gonna go right straight back to California. And all this time, I don't know where my daughter is. I haven't got a clue. I don't wanna say anything about it. I wanna raise alarm. And I'm just trying to talk my way out of it and they let me out. And when I got out, this couple that I had met, I didn't remember them, but my daughter was standing outside with them, you know, and they were waiting there. And I grabbed my daughter and I said, "Come on, baby, let's go. I told you Florida sucks, you know." And I can go on and on, because it never got much different than that. The next couple of years, me and my daughter, we lived in abandoned cars, we lived in missions, we lived in bus stations. Every once in a while, I would meet some very, very sick pre-Al-Anon woman that was going to fix me. And I would fix her, and never lasted very long, and we would just go from place to place, and every place I went, I had to leave. And we lived in five different states over the next 2 years, and there was never anything any different than the minute we started on our journey. In the last place, I'd gotten in a lot of trouble in Georgia, and I'd had to run, I'd make a dead run, and I got into Oklahoma. And I was in Oklahoma City, and I really wanted to put it together, and I just white-knuckled that I didn't drink, and I was crazy, and someone gave me a little job, and I started making a little job, and these people had a little rental, and they let me and my daughter live there. And we didn't have no money, hardly at all, just enough to eat. And I wasn't drinking. I'd go to work at this little job, and I'd come home, and I'd sit with, we didn't have a radio or television or nothing, and we'd just sit there, and I try to keep it together. And then one day, this guy, about a month, and we're on our way home. We've just gotten paid. He says, "Hey, you want to stop and have a beer?" And I went, "Yeah, a beer. That sounds good." And you know what happened. You know, I don't have to tell you. You've all stopped to have that one beer, or you wouldn't be here. I came in late that night, and I had blood on my clothes, and it wasn't mine. My little girl was sitting there, she was sitting on that couch, and I'll never forget it when I opened that door and I looked at her and she just looked at me and she knew. She picked up her doll and her pillow and stood by the door and I changed clothes and I said, "Come on, we're going back to California." And we got on that bus and I was so sick. And I got a big bottle of wine, I got on the bus, I started drinking, tossed out. I come to in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I come to when I was sick at the Malia's. I need a drink. And my little girl, she's crying. She's just rocking back and forth. I said, what's the matter? She got tears running down her eyes. She said, Daddy, I am so hungry. You haven't fed me. I said, baby, as soon as it stops, I'll get you something to eat. And we pulled into this little place, and I got off that bus, and I went and got me a bottle of wine, and I got her a sandwich, and I got up to go to pay for it. And I only had enough money for one or the other. And I had to put her sandwich back. I've done things in my life that I don't share with many people. My sponsor, never from a podium. I've never done anything in my life that haunted me more than that moment. Never, nothing even close to it. But I never forget my little girl looking at me, and she could smell that wine on my breath. And she had no one in this world except for me. And I couldn't even look at her. And a lady on that bus, thank God, just an old lady, she kind of just took her under her wing, and she had some food, and she fed my daughter. And I'll never forget the look of disgust that woman gave me. And that's another thing I had to live with, just that look that woman gave me. And I got back to California, and I do what all heroes do at the end of the road. I went to Mom's house. I'll tell you a little bit about my mom. I watched my mom stab my dad 2 different times. I watched her knock out the next door neighbor with a shovel for talking back to her one time. When my mom says something, you go, yes, ma'am, and you do it. You don't question, you don't ask why, you just do it. That's just the way it was. And my mom is the greatest woman in the world. I love her, she's my dearest friend. But you know what, I'm 53 years old. If my mother tells me to do something, I go, yes, ma'am. Immediately, it's just ingrained, you know, and I don't talk back. And she looked at me, and she opened that door, and she looked at me, and she looked at her granddaughter, and her hair was dirty, and her clothes was dirty, and she just looked at her, and she grabbed her granddaughter, and she looked at me with the most worst contempt I've ever seen a human being look at anyone. She said, get off my property. And I said, yes, ma'am, and I backed up, and I left, and I thanked God for my mom. She took my baby and saved her life, probably. Next 3 years, I don't know too much about it. I know a lot of hearsay. I know a few little events. I know I went to jail 52 times for drunk in public. I lived in Carlsbad, a state beach, in this little bamboo patch on this bank down in the Pacific Ocean. And right across the Pacific Coast Highway, there was a 7-Eleven. And I would panhandle for wine there. And I panhandled for wine until I got some. I would go drink it, and I would go back and panhandle. And I would do that until I either got hurt or I got arrested. Or something happened, and you would put me in bars or a straitjacket or something. And as soon as you let me out, I went right straight back. And that was my life. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank. One morning, I was standing out in front of that 7-Eleven. And I was so sick. I was so sick. I'm totally physically addicted to alcohol. I cannot stop drinking. I don't know if there's anyone here, you know, winos that have ever gone into convulsions, have grand mal seizures on a sidewalk because you couldn't get a drink. But I've had that happen to me more than once. And there's a certain feeling, and you know it's coming, and you know fear like nobody else in this world will ever understand, you know. And I'm standing in front of there, and I need a drink so bad. A short dog cost 85 cents. I got 65 cents, and I'm so sick I can hardly even panhandle. And this guy came up, and I'm scared. I fear I know what's going to happen. I know I'm going to start going into convulsions if I don't get a drink real quick. And this guy pulls up, and he's got this four-door square sedan, and he's got his square suit on. He's got short hair. He's got this square little wife sitting in the front seat. He's got this square little kid sitting in the back seat, you know. And I'm going, God, how can they live that way? You know? And he got out of the car, and he looked at me, and the guy gave me $2 without me saying a word. And you believe in God one more time when something like that happens. I ran in that store and I grabbed me a quart of wine and a short dog. I paid for it and I'm walking out the door and I'm pulling that crack and I'm taking a pull off that bottle, trying to get it in my body as fast as I can. And I'm walking away and I look in the side of the glass and I see that family sitting in that car looking at me. And I know they're judging me and I curse them. And I went down in my little bamboo patch and I started sucking on that bottle of wine going, La Puerta, in the doorway, you know. I don't know what's going to happen, but anything's better than this. I ain't here to talk about religion. I don't believe religion has any business in Alcoholics Anonymous. With all my heart, I believe that. But I'm going to tell you something, that family, that was a real good Christian family. They were on their way to church. They're good friends of mine today. And they were not judging me. As I wandered off, they got out of their car that morning and they got on their knees and they prayed for that poor drunk, that whole family. Well, I'm going to tell you something. I had the weirdest thought about the time they were praying for me. I believe with all of my heart, I had nothing to do with getting sober. People prayed me into these rooms. I believe in prayer with all my heart. They prayed me in these rooms. By the time they're thinking about, I'm thinking, I have this weird idea that maybe I ought to go to A&A. And I have no idea where this thought came from. See, I've been to A&A before in these hospitals and these detoxes and jails. And those H&I people would come in with that big blue book, you know, and they'd start talking about it. I would patiently explain to them that I'm not an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford any drugs right now. No. I mean, we all know a drug addict has a lot more class than any alcoholic, you know. But I had the thought, maybe I remember they had told me that, you know, we love newcomers, we love new people, we'll welcome you with open arms, you know, and I'm a user. I just tucked that away and I said, you know, that's the place I'm going to go someday, they'll let me in. And I don't remember how I even found this place, it's all kind of blurry, but I remember this, because this was the turning point of my life. I walked in this room and the meeting was already in process, it was going on, and I came in the back door and I'm waiting for this onrush of people to come up and start loving on me, you know, and I look them around. And people turned around and looked at me and they just kind of looked a shock, and I sat down next to this little girl and she scooted all the way down and people were kind of looking over at me and nobody's welcoming me. They're just kind of looking at me and, you know, I've been living in the same clothes for 3 years. My hair came down past my belt and my beard did too. I weighed 130 pounds. I had wine sores and a lot of things lived on me besides me. And I sat down, and I was kind of a science project, you know. It's, what can a human body withstand, you know? And people are kind of going, and I'm looking around, and then I start listening. You're talking about God. And I'm going, oh no, oh, knew it, zealots. And then you pass the basket. I said, they're gonna start singing. I'm nervous. I am so nervous. I'm sitting here and I know. I'm wondering if maybe they have a room for the more severe cases, but you guys do not look like alcoholics to me. And I'm going, geez, I got to get out of this place, you know? And I stood up to leave. And my angel, there was a woman who, when the minute I walked in, she was an elderly lady. And she kept staring at me from the minute I walked in that room, and she kept smiling at me and she, like that every time. I thought she was nuts, you know? And one of those brain-damaged women I'd heard about. Wet drunk. Sick as I was, I knew I had nothing she wanted, you know? And I'm looking at her, and I stood up. I got to get out of here. I am so nervous. I'm so uncomfortable. And she shot to her feet. And someone else was talking. She's holding on to me. She's saying, don't go nowhere. We need you. It's going to be okay. So I started coming to A&A. And y'all lied to me right from the very beginning. Every one of you. You told me if I'd stop drinking alcohol, my life would get better. I have no idea what alcohol does for you people. But I'm going to tell you straight up, alcohol is not my problem. It has never been my problem. It never will be my problem. It has, my drinking has caused problems in your lives, you know. But alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol is my solution, man. That's the only thing that allows me to live in this world. And after I stopped drinking, after about 3 or 4 days, man, I'm going, my God, why would anybody ever want to feel like this? Why would you ever want to feel like this? Everything is so real. All this stuff, you know, all these feelings, all these emotions, all these memories, all this stuff. How can you possibly go through life without alcohol? I drink. I'd have to drink. Couldn't see how you guys could stay sober. You told me that I needed to get a sponsor. I said, what's a sponsor? And they told me, I said, that sounds like a parole officer. I've been on parole half my life. I'm not going to volunteer to one of these squares about me. I don't need that stuff. And they said, well, you got to do these steps. And I said, what are these, what steps? And they showed me these steps and said, I'm powerless. I said, I'm not powerless. I've been carrying a gun since I was 15 years old. I'm in a kind of a bad luck streak at the moment, but I'm not powerless, you know, by any means, I'm not powerless. And I said, your life's unmanageable. I said, well, of course it is. I like it that way. Mediocrity is my greatest fear. Came to this insanity thing. You know, they've been treating me. I tried to kill a kid when I was 11 years old because he stole a Coke bottle from me. And they made me go see these psychiatrists, and they told me that I was antisocial, apparent, and all these different things when I was 11, 12 years old. You know, so I've been insane all my life. What are you going to restore me to? So I don't, that guy one really confused me. I went past that one. Then it got to the God stuff. Don't need God. If there was a God in this world, he don't like people like me. He likes those people that live in the suburbs. You know, he don't like people like me. You know, the things I've done, the things I've seen people do in this world, the things I've been exposed to, if there was ever a God, he had an awful perverse sense of humor. I wanted nothing to do with this God. And I drove right by that one. Then I get to this next one. I said, what's this? He goes, well, you got to write down everything you've ever done and make and tell another human being. I fell out of my chair laughing. Man, I learned. I don't know. That might be okay for you guys that live in the suburbs, man. But I lived on the streets. I lived in the jungles, man. And I learned it a long, long time ago. You don't cop to nothing, even if they got pictures, you know? You don't ever share a weakness with another human being, man. You don't ever talk about fear. You don't ever talk about any of that stuff or anything they can convict you of, you know? You don't share a weakness because people will use that. They'll eat you up with it. The only thing you ever tell people is what they want to hear. So you can get your hand in their pocket or their pants, depending on what you're after, you know? You don't ever tell the truth. What for? What is the truth anyway, you know? Don't need that one. It's really confusing. I went by that one. Saw this thing about defects. I didn't understand anything about that, but I just saw this other one. I said, what's this? He goes, well, you got to make a list of every person you've ever harmed, and then you got to go back and face them and make it right. Fell out of my chair laughing. I can see it now. Loopy. Hey, it's Kip. Hey, man, I'm sorry I shot you and your dog. Took all your dope, but I'm in recovery now, you know? No, man. And I didn't burn bridges. I nuked them. You don't go back until all their kinfolk are dead, you know? Might be okay for you people, but not me, man. My case is different. And I don't need this stuff, but I'm going to come to this A&A because there's something you got. I don't know what it is. There's something you got I want. And it wasn't your women. It wasn't your money. It wasn't your stuff. It was a look in the eye some of you had. And I wanted that. It was calm inside your head. I could see it. And I wanted it. I kept coming to these meetings, and I kept coming to these meetings, and I came to meetings for almost 6 years on a regular basis, and I couldn't stop drinking. And you welcomed me back. And there was people in those rooms. There was people. There was people like Harry. There was people like my sponsor, Pat T. There was people like Cliff Roach. There was people like Bill Blake and a group of other men who, no matter what condition I came in those rooms, they would welcome me. You know, and I'd come in and I would steal your money and you'd tell me to come back. I'd come in, I'd puke on your floor and pass out and you'd tell me to, hey, you'd clean it up and say, hey, keep coming back. I thought you people were nuts, you know, and you welcomed me. And I kept coming here and I wanted it and I wanted it so bad. I come to on Christmas morning, 1983, butt naked. Completely shackled. Cops had beat me so bad my face, I was in this rubber room and my face was stuck to the mat. And I'm trying to peel my face off the mat, it was stuck. And I kind of peeled it off and I rolled over and I looked at this little round room and there's these portholes and these cops were looking down and they were just smiling at me. And I just knew Santa Claus wasn't coming. That was not a unique experience for me, believe me. And I found out it was the same thing. I've always had a lack of respect for authority. It's one of my major character defects. And I've never been afraid of cops, especially when I'm drinking. And I would always get in an argument with them. They would beat the hell out of me. They always have friends and radios, you know, and they never want a fair fight. And they just beat the hell out of you with those sticks, and I was so used to it, you know, and they just beat me so bad that time, and they let me go. I made a conscious decision that morning, I ain't going back to A&A. I am that person in chapter 5. I'm not going to get sober. I know I'm not. I can't imagine life without alcohol. I want what you got. I want it, but I ain't going to get it. It's just like everything else in my life. I ain't going to get it. And I just made a decision that day. I'm just going to go drink. Alcohol is the only thing that works in my life. And I had $90. I can't remember how I got it, but I had $90. And I went and spent every penny of it on Gallaport wine. That's a lot of wine. And I went in and I started drinking. And I drank. And I drank and I drank. And on January 6th of 1984, I hit that spot. Or talks about in a vision for you. And it's the nightmare of nightmares if you're an alcoholic like me. It says there'll come a time where you cannot imagine life with alcohol or without it. And if you've been to AA for a long time and AA don't work for you, it ain't gonna work. And all of a sudden the day comes and alcohol don't work. The magic don't happen no more. It doesn't take away the pain. It doesn't take away that loneliness. You know, I believe that this group, I believe that we know what the word lonely means better than any other group of human beings on the face of the earth. If loneliness would have been a tangible thing, it would have absolutely eaten me alive. I was the loneliest human being that had ever been on this planet. I knew it. If it would have been a tangible thing, it would have eaten me alive. It says you come to the jumping off spot and you wish for the end. You know, the thought of living that way, I knew I couldn't go on. I knew alcohol wouldn't work no more. I knew AA wasn't going to work. And life hurt so bad. It hurt my very existence. Just was on fire. I wanted out of here so bad. I pulled up my gun and I put it up to my heart. And I pulled the trigger and I blew my left lung and 2 ribs out. And it knocked me all the way across the room. I'm sliding down this wall and there's blood flying everywhere. You know, and the only thought I had, there was no fear, there was no nothing. It was just a peaceful feeling. And I said, thank God this is over with. Thank God this nightmare is over with. Let me out of here. Just let me out of here. And I come through in this hospital. You thought I died, didn't you? There was this old guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Harry knew him real well. A guy named Charlie Tuck. I hated this old man. Hated his guts. He was one of those alcoholics that was a grateful alcoholic, you know? I just wanted to puke on his wingtips every time he said it, you know? And that old man, the reason I hated him so bad, he came up to me in a meeting one time when years I was coming in and out, and he got dead in my face. He leaned over that table and got right in my face. He said, look me right in the eye. He said, you think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid? I looked him right in the eye and gave him my best jailhouse look. I said, I'm tough enough, old man. Don't you ever doubt that. He looked at me and he got this big grin on his face. He said, you ain't tough. He said, you're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room. That might make you dangerous, but it don't make you tough. And he walked away laughing at me, you know. I'll tell you what, man, anytime I went to a meeting of alcoholics, I would make sure I got there late. I'd walk all the way around the room, the window, looking in the windows to make sure he wasn't in there. Well, I'm going to tell you, when I got sober and I did my inventory and I got to my fears list, I'm going to tell you what the fear that had run my life. And that fear was this. I was scared to death of you men. I was terrified of you. Absolutely terrified of you. But I would rather have you kill me than to see the fear. I'd do anything this world proved to you I wasn't afraid of you. But if you could see inside here where I live, you would know I was the scaredest kid in the world. I was still that scared little kid. I was afraid to go out of my parents' house, and I was afraid to go in because I knew one of you guys were going to beat my ass. You know, I knew that. And that old man saw it. He knew exactly who I was and what I was. So I avoided him like the plague. But when I'm in this hospital and I've been in a coma for about 4 days and I'm coming out of this coma, and I hear Charlie had the deepest, graveliest voice that ever hit this planet. You could be at a meeting with 10,000 people. If Charlie was there, you could hear him laugh. You know, he had this special voice. And I'm coming out of this coma and I hear this voice and I go, no. And I open up my eyes, and there's Charlie Tuck standing at the foot of my bed. He's got these 2 newcomers, and he's got this big, ugly blue book. I know I've died, I've gone to hell, and AA's here. And Charlie's in charge of it, you know? And I'm going, oh, God, he's going to start preaching A and A. Is there no peace anywhere? And Charlie Tuck did not say one word to me. He put his arms around those two young men. He said, "You see this poor, pathetic human being laying here?" And their eyes got real big, and they looked at him, and they went, "Yeah." They go, "This is what happens to an alcoholic who doesn't take the steps. Come on, let's go." Hurt my feelings, you know. I was in that hospital for a long time. I'd done an awful lot of damage to myself, and I got out of there in April. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I ran into an old friend of mine, one of my old smuggling partners, you know, and he had lots of money in a big house on the hill. He said, "I'll come on up here until you heal up." And I went up there, and I'm drinking. I'm using. I'm putting anything in my body trying to get something to work, but it don't work. It don't work. Nothing works. Nothing takes away that loneliness. Nothing takes away that pain in my very soul. Nothing will take it away. And every morning I wake up, I'm going, "God, I'm still alive. I just want out of here." When I come to on May 12, 1984, the same way I come to 1,000 times, I come to very early, and I open my eyes, and I know I got to get something in my body as fast as I can, because the screaming's going to start any second. I need to get some. Maybe it'll work today. Maybe something will work. Maybe something will work. And I've been to so many of these meetings, the A&A, that y'all have poisoned my mind. You know, because the only thing I could think of that morning was in that state of mind, laying there, the ABCs at the end of chapter 5 is going over and over in my head. That's a weird thing to be thinking about first thing when you wake up with the malaise and you're sick and you need a drink and you're thinking about the ABCs. I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm an alcoholic. I got no problem with this denial I hear people talk about. I thank God I'm an alcoholic. I would have blown my brains out if alcohol wouldn't have been around. In the book, it says it don't matter what I admit to you or anyone else. It says it's to my innermost self where no one else can see. I start thinking about that. You know, I'm thinking, laying in that rack, and I need a drink, and I'm thinking about things, and all of a sudden I had that picture. It was like a vision. It was like a moment of clarity, and I had remembered that morning on that bus with my little girl, and it was like I was watching it, and I could see, and I could feel that emotion that I felt, and I could feel my daughter's pain and her fear, and I saw it so clearly, and it finally dawned in here in my innermost self where no one else can see. And this is what alcohol does to Kip Collins. When Kip Collins puts alcohol in his body, from that very, very second on, from that second on, it's my master. I don't care. I don't care about my plans, my dreams, my morals. I don't care about yours either. I got to do whatever alcohol tells me to do, and what it says, "Get me some more. I'm going to take care of it." And there's no room in this whole world for another human being in my life unless you're going to help me drink. And alcohol tells me where I can go, tells me where I can sleep, tells me when I gotta get up, tells me who I can hang with, tells me how far I can go, runs every area of my life. There's no room for nothing else but alcohol. I understood that in my innermost self, what alcohol does to me. And it makes it that no human power was ever gonna fix me. That scared me to death. I kept hoping one of you people were, especially one of you gals, I kept hoping one of you pretty gals were gonna fix me. Some of you tried. I wanna thank you. You should have listened to your sponsors. And that left only one thing left, man. That God stuff. I've been dodging that since I came here. Been dodging that since I got here. Start thinking about the people who had what I wanted. The people who had that certain little special look, that glow in their eyes. How many people were here when Cricket was here last night? Did you see that woman glow from up here? She not look like a 20-year-old young beautiful girl just glowing, man. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. People who had what I wanted. And all those people talked about this power. I got on my knees that morning and I said this prayer with the most sincere moment since I hit this planet. I said this. I said, "I don't know who you are and I don't know what you are. I sure hope that don't make no difference. From this moment on, I'll do anything you put in front of me if I don't have to drink today. And if you're not there, I'm screwed. And the only thing I know is that something happened right then and there inside here where I live, and I do not have the vocabulary to tell you. It wasn't no big blast of wind like Bill Wilson or anything else. It was a sudden realization that if I could hold on to that simple concept, I wasn't going to have to drink. And I ran over as quick as I could, and I got to Charlie Tuck's house. Where else am I going to go? Where else am I going to go? Only man that wasn't afraid of me. Only one I couldn't bullshit. I knocked on that door, and his lovely Al-Anon wife, Edie, most precious woman on the planet ever hit. You know, she opened that door, and she got this big smile on her face. She said, "Oh, kid, Charlie's going to be so happy to see you." She goes, "Come on in the house, sugar." And I said, she looked at me for a minute. She goes, "Why don't you come around on the porch, you know, on the back?" So I go out on the porch. She, the lady, came out. She brought me a big glass of orange juice with Cairo syrup in it. She goes, "Drink this. It'll help." And I sat there. Charlie will be out in just a minute. And here comes Charlie, come walking out the back. He had that big, ugly blue book. He walks out, and he looks at me, and he says, "Kid, what can I do for you?" I said, "Charlie," I said, "I don't want to drink no more." He goes, "I've been hearing you say that for a long time. What's different?" I go, "I don't know. I just don't want to drink no more." He goes, "What are you willing to do?" I go, "Anything in this world you tell me." He goes, "Are you done?" And I go, "Charlie, I pray to whoever God is that I'm done." He goes, "That's the right answer." He goes, "Kip, I'm going to tell you something. I got some good news and I got some real bad news for you. Bad news is this: people like you don't get sober. People like you die in institutions. You die on the side of the road. They don't even mention your name in the paper. Something inside of you is badly broken. I don't know what it is. That's between you and your God. But the good news is this: it's very obvious to me that God has opened a window for you. I suggest you step through with both feet. And this is the way it's going to have to be for you, one day at a time, all the days of your life. And that is one simple fact: that absolutely nothing, no woman, no job, no child, no nothing in this world can ever be more important than you doing the things you have to do to maintain your sobriety. And that's a lot more than just going to meetings. Do you understand that?" And I said, "No, but I'll do it." He said, "Okay." He says, "Come with me." And it was Mother's Day. And he lived right across the street from Holiday Park in Carlsbad. And there's all these families out there having, you know, Mother's Day things, you know. And I walked out, and he dropped on his knees right in front of all these people. He said, "Get on your knees." And I'm looking around. And Charlie says, "Kip," he says, "these people have been stepping over you for 3 years. You're on your knees. You're halfway to your feet, boy." And I got down on my knees, and that old man taught me how to pray. And he said, "Don't ever, ever be ashamed of your God anywhere." And he taught me how to pray, and he took me back to his house, and we sat there. And Charlie Tuck told me his story. He got the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous out. And he started reading to me. And we started talking, one drunk after another, you know. Charlie was one of the first tapers in that area. And he'd sit there and we'd listen to tapes of other old speakers and people from Alcoholics Anonymous all over. And I stayed with him for about 3 days until I was okay. And he said, "Okay, this is a program of action. I got a set of action for you." He goes, "You're going to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night. You're going to get there an hour early. You'll stay for the last person. You'll beg for a job at every meeting you go to. You'll shake hands with every member that comes in that door. You'll never offer anything about yourself unless they ask. Don't ever ask anyone for a penny. You'll sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll get yourself a cup of coffee. When people are talking, you'll sit there and you will not move until they're done talking. You will not get up and go to the bathroom while a speaker's showing, no matter what. You will not move. You will sit there. You don't ever leave a meeting early for any reason whatsoever." He says, "You're going to get a commitment at a step study. You're going to get a commitment at a book study. You're going to get a commitment at a men's meeting." And a commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous is like this. It's not like anywhere else. That's a different word in here. When you say you've got a commitment in AA, there's only one excuse for not doing it, and that's you died on the way there. Period. You used up every excuse you had the day before you got here. You're all done. And that's the way it was. And I'm coming up on 90 days. He also gave me some, he told me to get a job. I've never had a job, really, you know. He told me I had to get an identification in my real name. That was a strange concept, you know. That was one of the scariest things I've ever done. I did that, you know. And I'm going to meet him. I'm coming up on 90 days. I said, Charlie, I almost got 90 days. He goes, so what? Oh, you know, 90 and 90. He goes, that doesn't apply to you. And I tell you, I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night for the next 3 years, no matter what. And I went to work every single day. He made me do things, ridiculous things, pay my bills. I'll never forget it. I got my first paycheck, and I'm going, damn, Charlie, they want every penny I made. He goes, they don't want one penny of your money. I go, pull up, they want all every, I mean, I got, they want everything I got. He goes, Kip, they don't want one penny of your money. They just want theirs. Whoa. Now that's a new concept. Simple little things that I never really understood, you know. I'll tell you something. Little man took me through the steps the first year. Exactly as written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm still working on my ninth step, and I will be to the day I die. I will never, ever finish that. There's just a list of records. They're so deep and so vast that I never stop. The minute I think I got something else, another one pops up, you know. But I do it. I take care of it. I met her in AA. There's always a her or a him for all of us here. For some of us, several. And I met her. She got sober on the same day I did. She loved to fish. God's will. We got married. Did not consult my sponsor, because I knew what he would say. He laughed. And we had a life in Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 8 years. It was incredible. We had one of the best marriages in the world. She was my best friend. She worked, I worked. We went to different meetings together. We were busy in AA, we were busy in our lives, and things in our lives happened. That, you know, at 3 years sober, the state of California gave me my driver's license back. And that's a whole other story, you know, but I'll tell you, my last 502, my sixth one, was 0.49, and I cut a pickup truck completely in half in front of someone's house, and that really pissed him off. He said I would never have a license in the state of California as long as I lived, but I got one in 3 years. At 3 years sober, I got my state contractor's license. I've only been to the seventh grade. Yeah. I started making money. I went down and bought a brand new pickup, paid cash when I got a driver's license. I signed a contract for a giant skyscraper downtown San Diego, and I was going to make a lot of money, and about the same day I got a phone call. And this little girl, she says, is your name Kip Collins? And I said, yeah. She goes, do you know Sandy so-and-so? I said, boy, a long time ago. She goes, that's my mother, and you're my father, and I want to get to know you. And that little girl that was born all those years ago when I was in prison, she came into my life. She was 23 years old, and she brought me 3 grandchildren, you know. And I had a good life from you people to show her, to bring her in my home, you know. And I got to go make amends to her mother. And I got to make amends to the best of my ability to her. I got my custody of my children back. A little boy that had so much brain damage. They told me to pray that he died. You men taught me how to be a father. People like her, watching Pat, watching all these other men. I don't know nothing about it, but you taught me. You taught me how to deal. You taught me how to suit up and show up and do what I'm supposed to be doing. And I started doing those things, you know, and I got involved in my son's life. Really involved in it. I started working with him in his school, and I watched my son graduate from high school at the age of 23 years old in a special education class. It was the proudest day of his moment. And he came down the field, and they gave him his diploma, and he came and he gave it to me. And you guys gave that to me. He gave that to me. I threw that away. That little girl that I drug all around the country. Exposed her to things that no child should ever be exposed to. A man came up and asked me for my daughter's hand in marriage, and my daughter told him that you have to go ask him. That's my father. You have to ask my father if you can marry me. You guys gave me that. I threw all my righteous apparel away. But you taught me how to be a father in you. I gave my daughter a wedding that I pay $300 a month on credit cards, and I probably will the rest of my life. But I walked my daughter down the aisle, and I handed her to this man, and my daughter looked at me with the love I always wanted all my life from my child. She graduated. She's got her master's degree last year, 13 years in night school. National Honor Roll Society, magnum cum laude. She got her master's degree in special education to work with children like her brother. And she's teaching at a special education school for brain damaged children today. And she's a wonderful, wonderful woman. And she's part of my life, and she lives down the street from me. And you guys gave that all to me. I went to Australia. I got to travel around and go to meetings of alcoholics and all over the place down there. And I came back, and I'd made almost $500,000 that year, legally. And I had everything in my life going on. It was just unbelievable what was going on. How do you possibly get from there to here? Impossible. Can't do it. Absolutely impossible. My family are all Pentecostal evangelists. I met a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who I fell in love with. His name was Father Bill Wilson. He became my godfather, and I became a Roman Catholic just to give my family something to pray for. They talk about me every Sunday. Came back from Australia, and I'm sitting in my house, and I got a big, nice house up on a hill, and my new truck, and my boat, and my family, and my love, and all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous I love, and my church, and all this stuff. I'm just, well, how do you possibly get there? And I open up the newspaper, and I'm reading the story on the very front page. And it's a story about a man who broke into a woman's house and raped her all night long in front of her children. And then when he was done, he took a knife to her and cut her to pieces in front of her children. I'm thinking, my God, what an animal. And I got down to the bottom of the story, and I found out it was my daughter. I'll tell you all something. I'm absolutely perfectly capable of first-degree murder if you touch anything in my life. I come from a world where that's not uncommon, you know, and all I know is, man, that I don't know anything about anger. I don't know anything about any of that stuff. I know about it getting real ice cold inside of me where I live, and I start making plans. I don't talk about it because I learned a long time ago I hate co-defendants, you know. I don't talk about things like that. I hold that stuff inside. I start making plans, and I can't go to meetings. I can't talk to nobody about nothing. And it's just ice cold inside where I live. He says in that book, I'm looking in that book, my sponsor said that nothing can be more important. I go, he don't understand. He didn't talk about this. He don't understand. He says in that book, I'm looking for a loophole. I ain't looking for a solution. And this is what it says. If you've got a resentment, you can't get rid of it. It says in there, it says, anger, resentments are the dubious luxury of normal people. But for us, they're poison. Because they'll cut me off from the sunlight of the spirit. And the insanity will return, and I'll have to drink. And my sobriety is contingent upon my spiritual condition. Because if I got a resentment I can't get rid of, I got to get on my knees and pray for that man to have everything out of life I want. Hardest thing I've ever done since I hit this planet was get on my knees and pray for that human being to have everything out of life I wanted. Never done anything in my life that was harder than that. Part of my prayer is our paths don't cross. He just got out of prison 2 weeks ago, and he lives in the town right next to me. And I pray we don't meet. But the insanity went away. That insanity, that ice cold. And I went to my men and my group, and I talked, and I went, and through you people in here, and you taught me how to be, you taught me how to go be a father to my daughter. She survived. She lost her face, her breast, and her left arm. And I got her as much psychological counseling as I could afford, which was quite a bit. And I got my grandchildren. I took care of them. And I became a parent. I became her father. When she needed a father, she did not need the kind of man I used to be. She needed a father for the first time in her life, and I was a father, and I was there for her because you taught me how to be a father. And I got through it, and I didn't have to drink, and I didn't have to hurt nobody. I didn't have to hurt myself. And it worked. Right after that, they told me that I had cancer. And they're going to cut off my lower lip. I like my lip where it's at. I'm telling me they're going to have to go through this surgery. It's going to be very, very painful. And I'm telling them, I'm saying, you know, you can't put any narcotics in my body. You can't put anything in my body that affects me from the neck up for any reason. I'm going through a lot of emotional pain right now with my daughter. And if you ever cut me off from that pain, I said, I don't know if I'll ever be able to get back to it. I mean, there are no exceptions. You can't put anything in my body. I would rather die of the cancer than you put a drug in my body. I can't do it. And I went through that surgery. I'm not telling anyone what to do. I'm telling you about me. Because see, I did a lot of brain damage to myself up there. There's only one couple things I know with absolute certainty. I know that that's up. I know this is down. I know that. Because, you know, I can drop something and it'll fall. You know, I know that that's solid. I know also that no matter what I got to do to stay sober, no matter what I got to do to stay sober, it's easier to stay sober than to get sober again. I know that just as clearly. And I went through that. I did not go through it with any kind of dignity whatsoever. My men and my home group are a lot like you guys. They have no sympathy whatsoever. They come over very caring, but then they try to tell you jokes. And they've cut your lip, and they've cut it from here to here and down to here and taken a wedge out and put everything back together and sewed it, and you don't even smile very well. You know, and they try to tell you jokes, but these guys are sick, and I pray for them. But you know, they sat with me, and they loved me, man, and they sat with me, and they sat with me until I got through it, and it worked. I didn't have to put anything in my body, and it worked one more time. Something had been going on with my wife. I'll tell you something, Connie, I loved you with all my heart. Here in the care of Connie. First woman I ever experienced intimacy with. And I ain't talking about sex. I'm talking about taking off all the armor in broad daylight and letting her see exactly who and what I was, and she didn't back up. Only woman I've ever done that with in my life. And I loved her. I loved her like I'd never experienced love for another human being other than my children. And I loved this woman. Never known that emotion before. You guys taught me how to love. You taught me how to do that. I didn't know how to do that. But you taught me. You opened up all those things and took all that armor away from me and allowed me to experience all those feelings. But something had been going on with Connie. I didn't know what it was, man. And I came because I'd been so involved with my daughter and the surgery. But there had been something going on with her. And I came home and she was crying. I said, what's the matter? She goes, Kip, she goes, I don't want to hurt you. I said, well, don't. She goes, I can't do this no more. I'm going to drink. I go, what are you talking about? She goes, Kip, she goes, I'm a lesbian. And I'm in love with Chrissy, and me and her are leaving. I can't do this no more. I didn't think she was going to tell me that. I didn't have any tools for that. I started screaming and ranting and raving and going, man, I didn't know. I know what I'm doing. She's Catholic. I'm Catholic. Father Bill, I'm going to go rat her out. I'm going to go talk to Father Bill over in Old Hollows Church in La Jolla. He'll know what to do with this. I go over to talk to Father Bill. He takes me in. I tell him this sad story. He looks at me and he shakes his head. He goes, you're pitiful. I go, what are you talking about? Because you remind me of that guy on page 61 in the book. You're just pitiful. I said, what are you talking about? Because, you know, that guy they talk about, and I said, thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he only did everything right. You keep telling me all these wonderful things you did for this lovely woman and her children, and you did this, and you did that, and you did this, and now she has treated you so bad. Because did you do those things because you loved her? Aren't you doing them to try to control her? You're still sick. There's still a hook in everything you've got. You don't know anything about conditional love. I said, so what do I do? He goes, you owe her an amends. I go, I owe her an amends? He goes, Kip, he says, I'm your confessor. Who are you to stand in judgment of anyone's sexuality? You're not God. The very first requirement on the bottom of page 62 tells you very clearly, the first requirement is you have to quit playing God. So it's the keystone of the new and triumphant arch to which you're going to walk through to freedom. And what you're doing here is you're playing God. Uncomfortable, isn't it? And I go, yeah, it is. And he goes, you need to go write an inventory about love. Tell me everything you know about love. As far as I can see, this woman honored her vows until she couldn't. Her sexuality is between her and her God. It's none of your business. She's not your property, she's your wife. And I went back and I wrote an inventory on love, and I looked at my wife and I realized that she had been my dearest friend. And we had spent a long time building a real good relationship, and we had a real good relationship. It had just changed and evolved, and I didn't know you could let a relationship do that. I didn't know that could happen. And me and my wife got a divorce, and she kept my last name, and she became my sister. I didn't know you could do that. When a woman does you wrong, you kick him to the curb, you know, and you go next. And we didn't have to do that. We didn't have to throw all of that relationship away, you know. And she's a dear friend of mine. And she stayed sober, and I stayed sober. And neither one of us had to drink, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked real good. Right after that, I got attacked by a dog. They call me Lucky where I come from. I got attacked by this damn dog, and it almost tore my whole right arm off. And I'm in a hospital, and on the way to the hospital, I told him, I said, call Scotty. And one of the guys I sponsor, I said, Scotty, can I get to the hospital? Meet me there. Don't let him put any dope in my body. Scotty's president of an outlaw motorcycle gang, and he brought all of his buddies into the hospital. They surrounded my room. They told the doctors, do not give this man any narcotics. And they didn't. And they never left my room. They had an armed guard at my door at all times not to let anyone give me any narcotics for any reason, no matter how much I cried for them, you know. And I went through that, sir, and I didn't have to put anything in my body. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous stayed with me. And when I couldn't pay my bills, they paid them. And when I couldn't eat, they sat with me and they fed me and they sat up with me. You know, and I did so much damage, I couldn't work. And I'd spent my money on my daughter and all this other stuff and the wedding, and I was flat broke, and all the medical bills. And I had nothing. It was just down to me and my son. And me and my baby boy, he was a California State Championship in bowling for Special Olympics. And we were very involved in Special Olympics. We went up to Los Angeles to go for the playoffs, and my son got sick there. And we had to go back and to go to the hospital, and he had to go in for one more emergency surgery. And as a result of that, he got a staph infection in his blood. And I sat with my son for 2 months, and I watched him die an agonizing death. And he died in my arms on October 4th. And it was at that time that I got to know, when the promises all came through to me, especially the part about serenity. He says, well, no serenity. I don't know what it means to you. I'll tell you what it is to me. Serenity is watching the thing you love the absolute most in this life die in your arms. Serenity is hurting more than I knew it was humanly possible to hurt. But at the same time, in my heart of hearts, knowing with all of my heart, with no reservations and no conditions, that this is God's business and it's none of mine. And it's not personal. And God don't make mistakes. And it's okay for me to hurt, but this is God's plan, and it has nothing to do with me. And knowing that in my heart of hearts. It was just me. I had nothing. Same way I came in to go to these rooms. 10 years sober, everything in my life was gone. Down to the clothes on my back. And this is what's happened from that day to this day. It was almost 7 years ago. I went to school. I got an education. I'd never been to school before. I got a degree in college, and I don't mean nothing, but I did that for me, and it kept me real busy, and I wanted to jam a woman into my life very quickly, and I told my sponsor, I'm very lonely. He said, you're not lonely, you're horny. He says, I'm going to give you some advice, and this is some of the best, most solid advice I've ever been given, and I thank you so much. He told me this. He said, Kip, I'm going to tell you, it's absolutely impossible for an alcoholic to have a relationship if they need one. It's absolutely impossible. You cannot have a relationship with a woman until you don't need a woman. Until you're comfortable in your skin. Until you don't need a woman to validate you as a man. Then you can have a relationship, but not a minute before that. And you said, don't do that to a woman. You can hurt someone. So you can be real careful. I said, well, can I date? And he goes, yes, but they can't spend the night. And I said, all right. You know, and I was really involved in school. I went out a few times. I had one little tour at a fair. And after about 2 years, you know, things in my life were real good. It was real comfortable. And I was just me and my dog in my tiny little house. And my boots were polished. My car was full of gas. You know, everything I liked to eat was in the refrigerator. I could watch what I wanted. Everything was cool, you know. And this girl called me up. It was a real pretty girl from one of the groups I went to. She called me up one night and said, "Hey, Kip, come on over. Let's have dinner at my house." And I said, "You know what? I'm going to stick it out around the house tonight with my dog. We're going to watch a game. But thanks anyway." And I hung up and I went, "Whoa, where did that come from? You know, where did that come from?" And I realized I was comfortable. I mean, I love, well, you guys are the greatest thing since banana peels, you know, but I was comfortable with my life. It was comfortable. And I went, "Wow, this is what he was talking about." So I scooted up. I said, "God, thank you. This is great. This is great. Comfortable. But if it be your will, God, I would love to experience true love one more time in my life. Let it go. Think about it no more." 2 weeks later, I got to speak down in San Diego, and that morning I got a phone call. And this girl that I dated the year before was her mom, and she said, "Oh, God, Carmen got drunk. She's been on a drunk for a while. She got in a bad car wreck last night. She got massive brain damage and broke both of her legs about 20 times places. And oh, she's just a mess." And I, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do to help?" She goes, "Yes, would you please come up here and pick up your daughter?" I said, "My daughter?" She goes, "You didn't know?" I said, "No, what?" She goes, "You have a 3-month-old daughter." I go, "I do?" She goes, "Yeah, I can't take care of her." I said, "Okay," and I got in my car and I drove up to Burbank, California, and I knocked on this apartment door, and this lady opened the door and she stuck this bassinet out the door. And I'm holding onto it on this front porch, and this little girl looked up at me and she smiled. And I fell head over heels in love. My heart exploded. I said, "Thank you, God." And I came back and all the guys in my group said, "Man, you better get a blood test, make sure that's your baby." I said, "No, no, no, this is my baby. God gave her to me. I ain't giving it back. You know? This is my baby. Her name is Nanu Nanu, you know, and I became a sober father, what I'd always dreamed about being. Little girl has never seen me drunk. She's never seen me hurt nobody. She's never seen me do nothing. You know, and it was just me and her and my dog. And I became a father, you know, and my heart was exploding, and I had everything I dreamed about having. You know, didn't have no money, but man, I had this baby, and she loved me, and I loved her. And my heart was on fire, man, and I'd come home from work, and I'd go take her to meetings with me. And I was at this meeting one night after about a year, and this gal I know, we got sober together, she said, "Hey, can I hold your baby?" And I looked at her, and I go, "I don't know, do you know how to hold a baby?" And, she goes, "Yeah, I know how to hold a baby." I said, "Well, be real careful." And I let her hold my baby, and I'm sitting there. I got close. I'm watching her, you know. I didn't let her out of my sight. And I'm looking at her, and all of a sudden, I see the way this woman is looking at my child. And I look at the way my child is looking at her. I'm going, I saw something I'd never seen in this woman before. I'm going, wow. So after the meeting, I came up. I said, "So, how's John, your husband?" She goes, "Oh, me and John got a divorce." "Oh, I'm so sorry." "You don't mind me asking, what happened?" She goes, "Well, I wanted to have children, and he didn't." "Could you like children, do you?" Me and Sabrina have been together from that day forward. We didn't move in together until we were married. And that's just something that I learned how to do around here. And we got married. And 3 years ago on September 10th, I went to a hospital, and I didn't wait in the hall. I went in the room and I sat with my wife, and I went through 9 months of Lamaze classes and went through all this stuff, and I sat there and I delivered my son, and I cut his cord, and I held him in my arms, and I promised him, "Ain't nobody ever gonna hurt you, big boy. Gonna be my pal." Because you see, I've learned how to be a father. These people in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to do the deal, and we're gonna have a good time. I named him Will Casey, God's Will. He's 3 years old now, and he's self-willed run riot. This is my message to you. The program of Alcoholics not going through. If you will live by the principles outlined in those first 164 pages, you will never have to drink again. You will never have to run from anything again. It will teach you how to live in a world that you do not understand. It'll teach you how to do things you don't know how to do. I want to thank you for my life. I want to thank you for all the wonderful things and all the things that have happened since I've been sober. You people have never left me. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, and my family thanks you, and that's all I've got for you. Not going through. If you will live by the principles outlined in those first 164 pages, you will never have to drink again. You will never have to run from anything again. It will teach you how to live in a world that you do not understand. It'll teach you how to do things you don't know how to do. I want to thank you for my life. I want to thank you for all the wonderful things and all the things that have happened since I've been sober. You people have never left me. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, and my family thanks you, and that's all I got for you.